Welcome to Black Art is Lit. I'm your host, Nakira Cheney, and on this episode, we're reading Stand Your Ground by Victoria Christopher Murphy. Janice Johnson is living every mother's nightmare. Her 17-year-old son was murdered, and the shooter has not been arrested. Can the DA and the police be trusted to investigate and do the right thing? Should Janice take advantage of the public outcry and join her husband alongside the angry protesters who are seeking revenge? Meredith Spencer is married to the man accused of the killing, and she sees her husband in a situation with far more clarity than anyone realizes. What she knows could blow the case wide open, but what will that mean for her life and that of her son? Will she have the courage to come forward in time so justice can be done? National best-selling and award-winning author Victoria Christopher Murray's Stand Your Ground is a pulse-pounding meditation on race, motherhood, marriage, and vigilante justice that will have readers spellbound until a shocking end. Now, normally, I like to jump, right into the book, but with this one, I felt that it was important to read her opening on why I wrote Stand Your Ground, as it's called. And, you know, given the time that we're currently in, what we're going through, it's just really important to highlight these cases. So it's great that the author took a moment to just sort of talk through this with us. So, not again were the words that kept reverberating through my mind on February 15, 2014. We were just about 6 months from George Zimmerman's acquittal of Trayvon Martin's murder, and as I watched the verdict come down in the first trial of Michael Dunn, the man who murdered Jordan Davis, I felt like this country was taking giant leaps backward. It happened again. While Michael Dunn had been found guilty of attempted murder, the jury couldn't reach a verdict on the murder charge for Jordan Davis's death. Of course, my social media timelines blew up. People were upset, and rightfully so, though I didn't understand the specific reactions. People were attacking the men and women of the jury, and then there were those who were once again calling for America to boycott one of its own states. Nobody go to Florida became the social media mantra. That confused me. I didn't understand how people could get upset with Americans who had not only stepped up to fulfill their jury duty, but who were following the law. And it was even more confusing that people wanted to boycott Florida when two dozen other states had some version of the same law. So what? Were we going to boycott every state? Were they going to boycott the states where they lived? I couldn't make sense out of what I thought was nonsense. I couldn't understand why people were attacking juries and attacking states and not going after the real culprit. Why not make this a political rallying cry? Why not register thousands of people to vote? Why not go after the law? Yes, people are behind the law, but not the people who would suffer under a boycott, and not the people who fulfilled their civic duty by serving on the jury. It was that night and those reactions that started the seed of this novel growing inside of me. I so wanted to get people to understand that the law was the problem. I wanted people to understand the law better. I wanted people to know that Stand Your Ground is not a defense in itself. It is part of self-defense. And though I had never been through anything like this myself, I wanted people to really think about the families in these situations. Maybe all of that will get us to finally stand our ground. Stand up and do something. Do something that would matter. Do something that would count. And while this idea began to brew inside of me, one of my friends on Facebook said, "Victoria, you should write a book about this." Others agreed, saying they believed that I could teach something. That was when I knew that I did have a platform to reach thousands of people about this. I could do it through entertainment. I could do it through a book. It was my editor who challenged me to add layers to this story and to show both sides of this tragedy. It was my publisher who gave me the title. And so it was on, and I was ready. But then I wasn't as ready as I thought. When I sat down and thought about these women in Stand Your Ground, the mother of the victim and the wife of the shooter, it became such a difficult book to write. Of course, the emotions that I had to write for the mother were clear and obvious. What I didn't expect was to feel for the wife of the shooter. These were two women who were suffering in different ways, but still both suffered. And as I lived with both of them in my head for all of those months, I suffered with them. Another thing that surprised me a bit about writing this book was the language. I believe in always being true to my characters, but to this point, profanity hasn't had any place in my novels. It's not as though there is such much in Stand Your Ground, but I'm sure you can imagine the N-word, a word I abhor, comes up a time or two. But if I wanted to write the truth, which I always try to do, if I wanted to speak to the two opposing sides of Stand Your Ground, I had to speak their language, especially the language they would use in this particular situation. So I went with my characters and I took this journey. Never before could I say that a book I've written has changed me, but writing this one did. It wasn't writing this book alone that changed me. It was that I was halfway through when Eric Garner was choked to death in New York, and then Michael Brown was executed in the streets of Ferguson. I wrote this novel while those incidents and their aftermath played as background music in my mind, and I changed. I wrote and I changed. I wrote and I became an angry Black woman. My prayer, though, is that I will channel that anger in the right way. I was able to work some of that anger out in the pages of this book. Now I hope that I'll be able to work that anger out in a way that will help to change America for the better. And that begins with repelling Stand Your Ground. We must know the facts. We must never forget. And that was the words of Victoria Christopher Murphy herself on why she wrote Stand Your Ground. Part one, Janice Johnson. I wish I could have been there to save him. There is nothing like being in love with a naked man. Now, I'm not saying that I didn't love my husband when he was fully clothed, but right now, right here, all I could do was perch myself up on my elbow and enjoy as my husband strutted around our room as if he were looking for something. He wasn't looking for a doggone thing. Tyrone was just giving me a show. And what a show it was. Because there is nothing like a naked, carved, and chiseled to perfection chocolate man. I sighed and my heart swelled with even more love than I ever thought possible. I didn't know it could be like this. Didn't know it could be like this after 16 years of marriage. Didn't know it could be like this after the betrayal of infidelity. What are you staring at? Tyrone's voice broke through my thoughts. He flexed his pecs and inside I moaned. What? What are you looking at? He asked again. Really? He was standing there full frontal and he was asking me what I was looking at. Did he want me to describe the human statue of excellence that he was to me? I answered my husband, nothing. I'm not looking at anything. He busted out laughing, then leaned over and kissed my forehead. I tugged at his arm, trying to pull him down on top of me so that I could do more nasty things to him. If our life were a book, it would have been titled Love and Sex. It had started with the marriage counselor that my friend Sarita had referred us to after the cheating incident. Stay in the bed, the counselor had advised. You have to connect again with one another sexually. Once you get the trust back in bed, because that's where it was broken, you'll be able to get the trust back in every other aspect of your life. That had just sounded like some man talking at the time. And trust me, it had been hard on both of us. But after a couple of months, we needed therapy to get us out of bed. It was like we couldn't stop, and the counselor had been right. We connected again in bed first, and everything else followed. But even though my husband was always down for second and third sexual helpings, this time he pulled back and I frowned. Don't worry, he said. I'll be right back. Turning away, he grabbed his bathrobe from the chaise. I'm going to check on Marquis, make sure his homework is done and he's getting ready to turn in. I bounced back into bed and sighed. Tyrone, don't start, Janice. It's barely 9 o'clock and you're sending him to bed? He's 17. Come on now. When are you going to let up on him? The expression of pure pleasure that had been on my husband's face just a minute before faded fast. Let up on him? Tyrone grumbled. We're raising a Black boy in a white world. I will never let up. I will never go easy. We've got just one chance to get this right. I get that, I said, having heard this lecture so many times. But if he was going to give me his speech, then he was going to once again listen to mine. It's been months since he was suspended, and he's done everything that we've asked him to do. All he does is go to school, then come home. He's back on track. See, that's my point right there, Tyrone said, jabbing his finger in the air. He's back on track. He should have never been derailed in the first place, and I want to make sure that he never gets derailed again. But what else do you want from him? We've got to let him know that there is redemption after repentance. We've got to teach him that he can do something wrong, but then he can make up for it by doing something right. He's a black boy in this country. He won't get a makeup opportunity. In this country, he won't be given a second chance. And our son has to learn that lesson now. That may be how it is in this country, I said, but we've got to let him know that it's not like that in this house, a home. He has to know that we trust him again. Tyrone shook his head. It was one joint, Tyrone. I said, for what had to be the millionth time since our son had received that 3-day school suspension a month ago. Don't make it out to be any bigger than that. When Tyrone opened his mouth to lecture me more, I added, don't forget you smoked when you were in high school. Yeah, but now that I know better, I've done better. And I wasn't at Winchester Academy when I smoked. I wasn't at some high school where the people that were expecting and waiting for me to fail. I sighed as Tyrone went on and on about how our son's mistake was much worse since he was at Winchester, one of the top college prep academies in the country. It had been my idea to send Marquis there since I recognized his brilliance from when he was in my womb. Seriously though, our son was smart and I wanted my only child to have the best opportunities, to give him a future that I could have never imagined for myself when I was growing up motherless, fatherless, oftentimes feeling homeless as I was shuffled from one foster home to the next. You know I'm right, Janice. Tyrone broke through my thoughts. Those white folks don't want him there, and he goes around acting a fool. He was acting like a 17-year-old. I held up my hand before Tyrone could pounce on my words, and yes, he was wrong, I continued. But he's learned his lesson, and all I want you to see is that Marquis is a good kid. A really good kid who's going to do great things in life. I know he has potential, but if he's going to be great, he has to understand that he can't get caught up. He has to do everything right. Everything right? Really? It took all that was inside of me not to shake my head and roll my eyes at this man. Sometimes Tyrone spoke as if he were the only parent with dreams for our son, but I wanted the same, perhaps even more for Marquis. While Tyrone focused on his academics, accepting nothing less than straight A's, I focused on the fullness of the life that I prayed Marquis would have. I wanted him to be well-educated but happy with a wife and plenty of children who called me grandma. I wanted to see him growing up doing the things he loved, playing the saxophone and piano, writing poetry and participating in amateur golf tournaments. But none of that extracurricular activity mattered to Tyrone. He was a strict disciplinarian who walked a straight military line. I understood structure and parental control. It was just that sometimes Tyrone was so strict, even I felt stifled. I am letting up a little bit, Tyrone said as if he heard my thoughts. I let him go out tonight, didn't I? I couldn't help it. I laughed. You let him go to the library. Tyrone grinned with me. I let him go to the library with Heather, he said, referring to our son's girlfriend. While those words made Tyrone smile, the thought made me want to shout. And I wasn't talking about shouting hallelujah. This discussion was going fine. Why did Tyrone even have to bring up Marquis' girlfriend? His white girlfriend. She was the only thing that made me regret busting my butt, working those extra shifts at the post office so that we could send Marquis to Winchester. I guess you don't have nothing to say now, huh? Tyrone chuckled. My husband was torturing me and he knew it. He knew how I felt about Marquis bringing that girl home when there were all these beautiful black girls that he knew from growing up in church and even a few at Winchester. Every day I brought up a new name to him, but Marquis could not be moved. I have no idea where I went wrong, but sometime after Marquis became a teenager, he suddenly and only had eyes for girls who looked like Snow White. It sickened me. Though his son's preference for girls with blonde hair and blue eyes didn't seem to bother Tyrone, I didn't get that. My husband was always talking about white people this and white people that and how he lived in this country, but he was not of this country. Well, why didn't he have an issue with his son dating a white girl? Okay, I won't tell him that he has to turn in, Tyrone said, saving me from myself. because thoughts of Heather were getting me riled up. Now that Tyrone had mentioned Heather, I was beginning to think that maybe we should keep Marquis on lockdown and away from that white girl until he left for college in the fall. "Thank you," I said to Tyrone, "but I'm still going to talk to him, make sure that he has his head on straight since I did let him go out earlier, and I'm going to talk to him about the suspension." This time I did roll my eyes. "Make sure he understands the seriousness of it." "He does." "Make sure he knows it could have messed with his scholarship to UPenn." "He knows." "Make sure he understands why he won't be valedictorian now, even though he earned it." "He understands." "Well, if you can guarantee that he knows all of that, then he's off lockdown." Tyrone shook his head. "You're a softy, you know." He kissed me again as he tied his robe. "I son better thank you, because if you weren't so cute," I laughed, but then stopped suddenly when the doorbell rang and a hard knock followed. Tyrone and I frowned together. It was just a little after 9 now, and I couldn't imagine who would be coming by our home. Marquis and his friends knew that they couldn't hang out on school nights, even when Marquis wasn't on lockdown. No more than a couple of seconds passed before the visitor on the other side of the front door rang the doorbell, and then another knock. "Who can that be?" I asked, pushing myself up from the bed. Tyrone held up his hand. "You stay here, I'll get it." But before my husband could make it to the top of the staircase, I had wrapped myself inside my robe and stepped into the hallway. Marquis's bare room door was closed, which was the only reason why I was sure he hadn't bounced down the stairs to get to the door before his father. By the time I made my way to the top of the stairs, Tyrone was at the bottom and opening the door. "Mr. Johnson?" The door was open wide enough for me to see the two policemen, one black, one white, standing shoulder to shoulder looking like soldiers. "Yes," my husband said, his voice 2 octaves deeper now, the way it always dropped when he stood in front of men wearing uniforms. "May we come in?" the black one asked. Those words made me descend the stairs, even though I wasn't properly dressed for company. Not that two policemen showing up in the middle of the night could ever be called welcome visitors. "What's this about?" my husband asked the question for both of us. The policeman stepped inside, though Tyrone hadn't extended an invitation. Both men glanced up at me as I stood on the second stair, gripping the lapels of my bathrobe to make sure it didn't open and trying to come up with a single reason why two officers would be in our home. "Ma'am?" It seemed that the black officer had been assigned to do all the talking as the white one just nodded at me. "What's this about?" Tyrone asked again. They still stood shoulder to shoulder at attention as if this were a formal visitation. "Will you mind if we went in there?" The black officer twisted slightly, nodding toward our living room. "I'd like for us to sit down." If the officer had been speaking to me, I would have said yes just because it seemed like the right thing to do. But Tyrone said, "That's not necessary. Just tell me what this is about," because that was right to him. My husband had been raised on the hard streets of Philly where a policeman, no matter his color, was never an invited guest. The officers exchanged glances before the one said, "Marquis Johnson, is that your son?" Tyrone's eyes narrowed while mine widened. "What's this about?" It felt like that was the 50th time my husband asked that question, and now I needed to hear the answer too. "There's been a shooting." "Oh my God," I gasped and covered my mouth. "Did something happen to one of our son's friends?" The officers looked at each other again before the black one continued. "No, it's your son, Marquis. He's been shot." "What?" Tyrone and I said together. "That's impossible," Tyrone continued. "Marquis is upstairs. He's in his room." And then he yelled out, "Marquis, come down here." I didn't let even a second pass before I dashed up the stairs, taking them 2 at a time, moving like I hadn't in years. Not that I had any doubt. Of course Marquis was in his bedroom. He had come home while Tyrone and I had been spending some personal time together. I mean, he hadn't come into our bedroom, but he never did when we had the door closed. Tonight, he'd been home by 8, 9 at the latest. I was sure of that. Since Marquis had become a teenager, I never entered his room without knocking. But tonight, I busted in, and then I stood there in the dark. I stood there staring at the blackness, though there was enough light from the hallway for me to see that Marquis wasn't sitting at his desk. He wasn't lying on his bed. He wasn't here. "Marquis," I called out anyway, then rushed back into the hall and headed to the bathroom. "Marquis?" Just like with his bedroom, I busted into the bathroom and stared at the empty space. It was only then that I felt my heart pounding, though I'm sure the assault on my chest began the moment the policeman had told that lie that my son had been shot. "Marquis," I called out as I jerked back the shower curtain that revealed an empty tub. "Marquis," I shouted as I now searched our guest bedroom. No one, nothing there. I returned to his bedroom, turned on his light, then swung open the door to his closet before I crouched down and searched under his bed. Marquis, I screamed as I went into my bedroom, wondering why my son was playing this game of hide and seek, something we hadn't done since he was four. When he finally came out of hiding, he was going to have to deal with me. I rushed back into the hallway and bumped right into Tyrone. "He's not up here," I said to my husband as he grasped my arms. "He's downstairs somewhere. Did you check the kitchen?" "Wait, I know," I continued without letting my husband speak. "He's in the family room. I know you said he couldn't watch the TV in there, but you were about to take him off lockdown anyway, and you know that Marquis Janice." Tyrone shook me a little. I looked up into Tyrone's eyes, which were glassy with tears. "What?" I frowned. "You don't believe those policemen, do you?" He nodded at the same time that I shook my head. "No, they're lying." "They're not lying," Tyrone said softly. "They showed me a picture just to make sure." Now I whipped my head from side to side because I didn't want to hear anything else from Tyrone. I couldn't believe that he would accept the word of these two men in blue. Wasn't he the one that always said that you couldn't trust the police? Well, if he wasn't going to look for our son, I was. Marquis, I screamed. Tyrone still nodded, and now a single tear dripped from his eye. "Janice, listen to me." For a moment, I tried to remember the last time my husband had cried, and I couldn't think of a single time. "Janice," he repeated my name. "No, Marquis is gone. No, he was shot over on Avon Street. No, he's dead. Why would you believe them?" I cried. "Why don't you believe me?" My husband looked at me as if I was talking foolishness, and I looked at him and begged with every fiber of my being for him to tell me that he was wrong, or for him to wake me from this nightmare. Either scenario would work for me. But Tyrone did neither of those things. He just held me and stared into my eyes. And as I stared into his, I saw the truth. Not many words that Tyrone had shared had made it to the understanding part of my brain. But four words did. Marquis, gone, shot, dead. "Marquis is gone," I whispered. Tyrone nodded. "Someone shot my son?" He nodded again. "And now he's dead?" This time, Tyrone didn't nod. He just pulled me close, so close that I could feel the hammering of his heart. But though there were a few times when I didn't want to be held by my husband, I didn't want him to hold me now. I didn't want him to comfort me. Because what if Tyrone and these men were saying were true? I didn't want to be in my husband's arms. If everything they said about my son was the truth, then all I wanted was to be dead, too. Death. I couldn't get that word out of my head. Death. Even though I kept trying to. Death. I had to stop thinking about it, because if I didn't, the whole world would have to end. "Okay, Mr. and Miss Johnson," the officer said as he opened the door. "If you can have a seat in here, I'll be right back." "Please, I need to know about my son," I said. They had already kept us waiting in the front of the police station, had us sitting there like we were in the reception area of a doctor's office or something, and now they were herding us back to some room just to leave us to wait some more. But our waiting didn't seem to be any kind of a concern to the officer. He looked at me with eyes that didn't seem happy about having to explain himself again. "I need to get the detective, and we'll be right back." "But when will I see my son?" I asked right before he closed the door. Turning around, I moved further into the room and imagined this had to be how it felt to be confined in a prison cell. This room was that small and that cold. A rectangular table consumed most of the space, which was lit only by a single bulb hanging loosely from the ceiling. There was a window, a small one, but no light came from the outside. There was only darkness. Edging toward the table, I took in the glass on the opposite wall, and I wondered if the police were behind that mirror, like on TV, watching me. Though I wasn't sure what they expected to see, I was just another mother about to die from grief. I wanted to stand, but there was this blackened cloud that hung over me, making me weary. So I sat on the wooden chair that felt harder than it probably was. But I sat on the edge, ready to jump with joy when the police came back and told me this had all been a mistake. It wasn't until Tyrone took my hand and squeezed it that I even remembered he was with me, and if I'd had the strength, I would have thanked him. He hadn't left my side since we had heard this news, what, 1, 2, 3 hours ago? He had just gone about everything he could except breathe for me since, from dressing me to make sure that I didn't walk out of the house naked, to holding me steady on my wobbly legs. It was because of Tyrone that my heart was still beating. He didn't know it. But he kept me away from the medicine cabinet that housed all kind of old prescriptions that I never threw away but couldn't stop thinking about from the moment he convinced me that what the police had said about Marquis was true. What are the police doing? I asked Tyrone. But I didn't let enough time pass for him to answer. What do they have us locked in here? And why won't they let me see Marquis? He held my hand tighter as if that gesture was part of an answer. They want to talk to us first, get some answers. What kind of answers can I give them? I'm the one with all the questions. I know, my husband said, but let's be patient. That was when I knew for sure that the world had turned on its axis. My husband was calling for patience. With the police? For the first time, I realized that he was in shock, too. Tyrone kept on. They have to talk to us now because if they let us see Marquis first, he didn't have to finish. Talk first because after seeing Marquis, not only will I no longer be able to speak, I doubted if I'd even be able to breathe. I moved to stand, but before I could get out of my seat, the door opened and in marched a white officer who had come to our home, and with him this time was a different black man. This one wasn't wearing a uniform. It was the one I hadn't seen before who said, "Mr. and Mrs. Johnson, I'm Detective Ferguson. I'm really sorry for your loss." "Thank you," Tyrone said, though I didn't say a word. For me, for my heart, it wasn't official yet that I lost anything. "We just want to ask you a few questions." "I understand," Tyrone said, "but the thing is, my wife and I have questions too." My husband continued in a soft voice that I never heard come out of him before. "What happened to our son?" "All we know is that he was shot dead." The men exchanged a glance before the one named Ferguson nodded to the other. The other officer said, "Yes, but I think if we get some questions answered, we'll be able to fill in a lot of the blanks. Just a few questions." Tyrone nodded his cooperation. I didn't move a single muscle. The officer said, "Do you have any idea why your son was over on Avon in Haverford?" Tyrone said, "He was probably heading home after dropping his girlfriend off. She lives somewhere over in that area, I think." The officers looked at each other before the one who had been doing all the speaking asked, "Girlfriend?" Tyrone nodded. "Wait, was she with him? Is she all right?" The officer asked, "What's her name?" "Heather," and then Tyrone stopped. "He liked Marquis's girlfriend so much, but he didn't even know her last name," I answered. "Nelson, Heather Nelson, because I didn't like her, so I knew everything about her." "And Heather lives in that neighborhood?" "Yes, but is she all right? Was she with Marquis?" my husband asked again. "She's fine. She was with him. We only asked because we wanted to make sure that we were talking about the same young lady." "Oh my God," I pressed my hand against my chest. "She was with him when this happened? Then I need to talk to her." "We talked to her, ma'am, and that's why we needed to talk to you. Your son, is he a member of a gang?" "What? No," Tyrone said at the same time. And then the way my husband's shoulders rose up, I could see that the patient he had told me to have wasn't a part of him anymore. "And why would you ask us that?" he asked, his voice once again strong, once again 2 octaves deeper. "You need to answer that question and a whole lot more for me. What happened to my son?" They had mistaken my grieving and in shock husband for a passive black man. But the way he sat now, leaning forward with his arms flat on the table and his eyes giving them a stare that could have sharpened stone, the policeman decided to answer. "The reason we're questioning you is because we don't know exactly what happened and we're trying to put it all together." "Well then, tell me the part that you do know," my husband said, as if he was the one in charge now. There was a brief moment of silence as the men glanced at me, then back at my husband. "It seems your son was in the car with his girlfriend, and they were approached by someone," the one who'd been doing all the talking said. "A gang member?" Tyrone asked them before the police could answer. He added, "I don't care what that other boy told you. My son was not in a gang." Another glance exchange, and then, "Well, that's why we're asking you these questions. So do you have the shooter in custody? Do you have the boy who murdered my son?" "We're still trying to gather information," he said, his voice as steady as a weatherman's. "So are you going to tell me the name of the punk who killed my boy?" "We don't want to tell you something and then later find out we were wrong." "Well, right now you're not telling me anything." Tyrone's volume rose. The officer kept his voice level as he said, "We're telling you what we know and we're trying to gather everything so that we can give you a full account." "How are you gathering information from us when we weren't there?" I asked. You know things about your son, like whether or not he was in a gang, Tyrone spat. The officer nodded as if he were now the one with patience. We had to ask that. Because that's the first thing you think of when you see two black boys, right? My husband said, his tone accusing them. Well, I don't know about that other boy, but our son wasn't in a gang. The officer glanced at the detective, but the white officer was the one who kept speaking. We had to ask, just like we have to ask, did your son carry a firearm? Tyrone slammed his fist on the table, startling me and making both officers jump, though only the white one raised his arm as if he was reaching for his gun. Just as quickly, I placed my hand on Tyrone's arm, feeling the bulge of his biceps. My husband was ready to punch these men out, but since I just lost one half of the reason why my heart beat every day, I had to do everything that I could to keep the other half with me. So I kept my hand on him, and just like I always did, I calmed him down by my touch alone. Mr. Johnson. Those were the first two words Detective Ferguson spoke since his greeting. And he called my husband's name in a tone that sounded like he was giving him a warning. We want to find out what happened as much as you do. A couple of long moments and hard stares passed between the two black men before Tyrone finally sat back and held up his hands. We'll answer your questions and then you'll answer ours. The detective gave a slow nod. Fair enough, he paused. Glanced at the white officer, then leaned over. Okay, so did your son have any guns? Ferguson asked, taking over the interrogation. No, not that you know of, the other officer said. With a glare, my husband repeated, no. Then what about anything else that he had in his car, Ferguson asked. What do you mean? Any kind of weapon? Look, my son wasn't like that. Let me answer your next 10 questions for you. My son wasn't violent. He was probably 8 the last time he had a fight. He wasn't in a gang. He didn't sell drugs. He didn't carry any weapons of any kind. What about a baseball bat? Did he carry a bat? Detective Ferguson asked. I squeezed Tyrone's arm, but this time it was more for me than him, because this time I wanted to stand up and punch somebody. Tyrone said, no, he didn't carry a bat. Not that you know of, the other officer said again. Detective Ferguson must have known that was all my husband was going to be able to take. Okay, so let me tell you what we know, the detective offered. Your son and Heather were sitting in his car, just talking maybe. And this is where it gets murky. It seems that your son and the man who approached the car exchanged some words, but the man walked away. Apparently, that was when your son got out the car and there was some kind of confrontation that turned into an altercation. Then the detective stopped as if that were enough of an explanation. So how did my son end up dead? Tyrone asked. That's what we're trying to figure out. So some guy just shot my son, I said, for no reason. Your son got out of the car, ma'am, the white officer said as if that were reason enough. And now there's a death sentence for getting out of your car? That's why he was murdered, I cried. As we explained, Detective Ferguson was back to talking. We don't have the full picture yet. I just want to know one thing, Tyrone said. He glanced at the men as if he were telling them that they better have the right answers. The boy who killed my son, has he been arrested? Not yet. Why not? I screamed, feeling my tears on their way. Because we're still working on this, Ferguson said. The other added, he's claiming self-defense. And if it was self-defense, then I frowned. Self-defense? But I know my son. He didn't attack anybody. He got out of the car and there was a confrontation, ma'am. And if anyone feels as if his life is in danger, he doesn't have to retreat. He can stay and protect himself. My frown deepened as I thought back to the times when I heard words like that, similar ones on the news with all the recent killings of young black men. But that was down south, in Florida. That kind of thing couldn't happen here, not in the north in Pennsylvania. And it certainly was never used when one black man shot another. You're making it sound like he's saying he was standing his ground or something, I said. The officers nodded together and one said, Pennsylvania is a stand your ground state, ma'am. But I thought that was just in Florida. I was doing all the talking now. No, it's not. I wanted to burst into tears right then. I didn't know much about self-defense and stand your ground, except that everyone who used it in court seemed to get away with murder. Did this mean that the boy who shot my son was going to walk too? And that's just what I asked the officer. He shrugged. We're going to do our best to find out what happened and to make sure justice is served either way. I sat there stunned. The way these men were talking, this was just some black-on-black crime to them. They weren't given any indication that they would put much effort into this case. There was nothing else for me to say, But that was all right because I knew Tyrone would take over from now. And this time, I wasn't even going to try to hold him back. I didn't care if he started flipping tables or punching walls. Tyrone would demand justice, and by the time my husband finished, these officers would run out of here and arrest whoever had taken the light out of our lives. I watched and I waited. Then Tyrone finally opened his mouth. But the only thing he said was, "When can I see my son?" That one almost had me in tears. That is Stand Your Ground by Victoria Christopher Murphy. I feel emotional. Actually, I fought back tears as I was reading through that. I know I'll have to take a moment just to breathe because it's so real. And we can see it, and we've seen it time after time after time again. It's almost like it's a countdown to the next dead body. And I could not ever imagine a mother's grief at losing their child. I encourage you to go get this book and support this sister. Stand Your Ground. Thanks for tuning in. Talk with you on the next episode of Black Art Is Lit.